In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about making your first $2,000 from products, whether to look for a co-founder, rehabbing an existing product, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 259. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Well, tomorrow at precisely 4:29 p.m., Marty McFly arrives from the past.
Very nice. I've heard a lot of folks talking about it and then asking where are the hoverboards and the nuclear fusion thing that straps to your car.
And the fax machines, you know, don't forget those.
Indeed. What else is going on?
So I've spent the past couple of weeks doing essentially market validation for a couple of the different ideas that I've had. And I've been focusing really in on the one-to-one email sequences. And so far I've had 23 conversations with people. And of those 23 conversations, 11 people have said that they would pay me for it. So I'm still trying to work things out because there's, from one person to the next, there seems to be a lot of variation between the specifics of what they are looking for and the problem that they're trying to solve. Like, they're all very, very similar, but trying to nail down exactly what would work for the vast majority of them is kind of the hard part. It's just figuring out where that is and where I can get the most traction is, I guess that's the challenging part right now. And people are using different terminology for the same types of things too. So that makes it even harder.
For sure. For sure. And that's the hard part about customer development is that you're either going to get 20 different opinions or you're going to get several opinions that are the same, but you don't realize they're the same because they're using different vocabulary. And it's hard if something doesn't exist and you can't just show it to them to figure out if it's actually A, going to do what they want, or B, I mean, there's the little subtleties of with email. I mean, it could be cold email, it could be warm email, it could be bulk email, it could be, there's so many things, you know? So until you can figure out which stage they're using it at and how much value it has to them, like, have you talked price point at all?
I have. I've talked price point with virtually every single one of them.
Good.
So I have a ballpark idea so far of like where the MRR would come from if they were all to sign up today. But I'm at the process where I'm still just gathering information right now. And then once I have a better idea of what it is that the solution would look like, then I'm going to basically draw up the designs, go back to every single one of them and say, can I get a pre-order for this?
Mm-hmm. And how many people, you said you have 11 commitments. How many are you going for before you start moving forward?
I want to be able to get to the point where I have at least 10 who are willing to move forward on that commitment. So It's kind of nebulous as to how many I have to get to. Is it 15? Is it 20? Is it 25? It really depends on, one, how far I want to take it, how much I want to, like how much variation I see between people. If I think I have something that is going to fit for at least 12 to 15 people, then I'll probably start moving forward. But again, like I said, some of them are all over the map. So it's still up in the air right now.
For sure. Well, while you're in the process of adding to your product portfolio, I've actually been in the process of paring mine down so that I can focus on essentially on Drip and MicroConf and the podcast and my blog and my and the other stuff, but really have been either selling or I've actually given .NET Invoice to my business partner. And Hittail is up for sale right now through Thomas Smale at FE International. If someone is interested, it is still on the market. And so it feels good to be able to focus more on the things that are really working and double and triple down on Drip in essence, because that is where I'm spending the bulk of my time and it's where I think it should be spent for the next until it's done is what it is. And if that's 5 years or 10 years, that's where I'm at. I'm not in the mode anymore of the starting the next one after 1 to 2 years, which I was for a while, and building up the portfolio. I think I'm ready to head in the opposite direction and really build this one up. There's just a lot more opportunity and a lot more growth going on than anything I've done in the past. And so I'm doubling down on that.
Do you think that's a byproduct of the type of product this is in relation to some of the previous ones, or is it more of a career trajectory sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question to ask. I think it's partly both. Certainly, I'm at the point in my career where I do want to focus on some things that I really enjoy, and I kind of want to take things to the next level because it allows me to learn, and that's when I'm happy. You know, that's like my one of my definitions of success is learning a lot of stuff and being in control of what I'm working on. But I also think that if you look at Drip and you look at how large the market is, and if you look at the opportunity here and the price point, the average MRR per customer, I mean, just all these things are completely different than everything I've done in the past. So I think it's some of both to answer your question.
So what are we talking about this week?
We have a slew of listener questions. We're actually backlogged. Some of these are from almost a year ago, and apologies to folks who sent them in and, you know, haven't had us answer them yet. But we still want to answer ones that are general enough that I think they'll apply to most folks listening. Our first question is from Daniel McCready, and it's actually, it's not a question. It was just an email to say thank you. He says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. Really wanted to say thank you. I'm a longtime listener who's starting to see some success from your advice. As a full-time developer and now a technical lead, I don't get a lot of experience with marketing in my day-to-day job. Listening to your podcast has helped fill in some gaps and kept me from going down the wrong path. I've created a minimal product, a nice clean landing page that people actually purchase my product from, and I'm getting great feedback on feature enhancements that the customers want. I know I have a lot of work to do, but 20 sales in the first 2 months is a success in my book." And his subject line was, "I made $2,000 in the first 2 months." Yeah, thanks a lot for writing in, Daniel. His app, if you want to take a look at it, is at WooTicketStudio. That's WOOTicketStudio.com if you're interested in checking it out. And thanks as always for writing in with success stories. We'd love to hear from folks who have been longtime listeners and have implemented what we said, whether to launch a product, make the first couple thousand online, or to quit your job.
Yeah, great job, Dan.
All right. Now let's queue us up for our first question. This is actually, so this is from Justin McGill, and he sent it over a year ago. Sorry about that, Justin. But he asked us, "What do your daily and weekly schedules look like? Rob with his multiple projects and Mike with whatever he's working on at the time. I think both perspectives would be helpful." Why don't you kick us off, Mike?
I guess in terms of my daily schedule, I try to get up before 8 o'clock, and there are definitely days where that just simply does not happen. A lot of times my schedule for the day tends to be dictated by like how late I worked the previous day. So if I were working till 5 or 6 and then spend time with the family, and then if I decide for whatever reason to go back and sit on my computer and do some work or fool around or anything, there are definitely times where I've stayed up till 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and that will have a severely negative impact on my following day. So I try to avoid it as much as I can, but it does still kind of creep in there once in a while. And then for the rest of the time, I try to stick to a schedule where roughly from 8 to 5 I'm working, and then after that it's kind of, lately it's been up until about 3 to 4 o'clock, where after that it's been difficult to get things done just because my office has now moved upstairs. So the kids get home at 3. So there's definitely a lot more pressure to get everything done by 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock because the kids will start to interrupt. So that's generally what my schedule looks like. And I try to avoid working on Saturdays or Sundays, just kind of out of a matter of principle.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think I'm pretty similar to you. My schedule used to be very different. Obviously, it was all nights and weekends for a long time, for the first several years, because I was typically doing salary work or, in the later days, consulting. You know, in 2000, let's say 2005, 2006, and 2007, I was doing 30, 40 hours a week of consulting during the day and then working on products on the side. And then I hit a certain point where I just decided I really didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to do the night and weekend stuff. And so I will do some work in the evening sometimes. And especially if Sherry's out with the kids and I'm home alone, I will, unfortunately, I will tend to veer by the computer and either do email or work on something that needs to get done. I've been trying lately to not do that because I find that if I work too much, I just become not productive, and your work expands to fill whatever time you give it. And so I really have been trying to avoid that. But I do find myself, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, I read a lot, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I do find myself thinking about work, jotting notes down, doing a lot of kind of strategy type stuff in the evening if I have free time, or on the weekends, you know, if I'm whatever, out and about running errands or just doing stuff around the property. I wind up coming up with a lot of what I think are my best ideas when I'm kind of not sitting behind my desk, because that's when you're actually getting work done. But I'm out and about, I'm doing stuff. So I wouldn't say I work on the weekends or the evenings, but I do get kind of strategic thinking done. In terms of the daytime, I'm up by 7 a.m. I make breakfast for the family and then take the kids to school, one or both of them. And then I head into the office 2 days a week, 3 days a week, depends, and work from around 8:30 until whenever it's done, which is, about between 3 and 5, depending on the day. And so if I don't get a full work day in during that time, I will add a little time in the evening or on a weekend to make up for it, for sure. Our next question is about entering a competitive SaaS market, and it's from Scott Underwood. And he said, here are some podcast ideas for you. He says, do you have any thoughts or tips on entering a SaaS market with large competitors, meaning you take someone else's SaaS app or niche and you innovate on it?
I think there are some interesting opportunities in going into these types of markets, because you can essentially build, not necessarily features, but add-ons or plugins for other vendors and essentially build on top of their platform or on top of their application. And there's a lot of some people who've done this very successfully. I think the one thing you have to really be careful of is, I think what Joel Spolsky at one point called snatching nickels from the steamroller. And his reference point was the fact that people were building a lot of copy-paste applications back when iOS was first released and it didn't support copy-paste. And then all it takes for that entire business to go away is for them to implement that one feature. So there's got to be a compelling reason for them to not do it. And if it's a feature that is compelling enough for them to implement, you have to be careful, just because they will eventually kill your business. So if you're bolting something onto those larger applications, you do have to be a little bit careful of that. The other thing I'd say is, if you're taking a much larger application and just taking off like a tiny little slice of it, you can probably do a much better job than they are. But you also have to find people who are willing to pay for just that tiny slice of the solution as opposed to the entire thing. So those are the caveats around it, I think. In terms of my general thoughts on it, I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with it, but you do have to kind of pick and choose which of these battles you fight, because some of them are going to be worth it, some of them aren't. And there's going to be some where that larger competitor comes in and essentially squishes you, just because they come in and they have the resources to bear on the problem. And if it's important enough to them and to their customers, they're going to do it.
So you were taking that from the angle of building like add-ons for larger products or in their ecosystem. I would look at this. I mean, I think he's asking more about how to take on a larger competitor. So let's look at, I mean, obviously marketing automation would be an example. And I'm not building add-ons for HubSpot or Infusionsoft or one of those guys, but we are taking them on kind of directly as a one-on-one competitor. And so actually, I do have a lot of thoughts on this. I think that I got an interesting email. It was probably a year and a half ago from Drew Sinaki. He's a longtime listener of the show. And he asked, are you trying to do an innovator's dilemma to Infusionsoft? And I thought that was a really interesting way to put it. Have you read that book?
Yes, I have.
So the innovator's dilemma is where you're a big company in a market that's existed for 10 or 20 years, and the market's starting to shift, and there's a lower cost or an easier solution that's coming in front of you, but you won't cannibalize your business in order to take advantage of that new market opportunity. And so IBM has seen this, really, you know, Microsoft is seeing this. It happens with a lot of larger technology companies in general as the technology changes. And I thought it was a really interesting way that Drew put that in email. It got me thinking. I actually went back and listened to the book again. I hadn't listened to it in a few years. And I think that that's the tactic that you need to take if you're going to go after. Or I think it's probably the optimal tactic. There's probably many you can do. But that's the approach that I would look at doing, is to basically couch yourself as the opposite of whatever they are. So if they are big and cumbersome and clumsy and they don't add a lot of features and they're hard to use and they're expensive, well, start off as being the opposite of all of that, you know, and you can be pretty intentional about marketing yourself as that. If you go to the Drip homepage, that's really, I mean, you know, there's a couple thousand words on that page that really are positioning us as the opposite of the larger players. And after that, it's execution, right? I mean, you actually have to really build a better app. You can't just build a clunky app and expect that since you have fewer features, you're going to be easier to use, because that's not the case. So you need to focus a lot on usability and really double down on your differences, and also try not to get the feature bloat that a lot of these larger apps have, so you can't build everything that everyone's asking for. So those would be my thoughts about kind of an early advantages when heading into a market with heavy competition. The other question Scott had for us, he says, do you have any data or lessons learned from Drip for the most effective opt-ins for building an email list? I know you don't like the exit pop-up forms, but I've seen several people tweeting how effective they are. He's talking like the a bounce exchange exit intent pop-up. Do you have thoughts on those? Do you use one of those?
I have tested them. I'd have to go back and look look. I think that I might actually have it on my blog. I don't remember if I went back and either disabled that or changed it. But I do remember testing it. And now that you bring it up, I don't remember if I ever actually went back and looked at the results of that test, because I probably got distracted. So that's totally on me. I mean, I've heard similar things, like people have said over and over and over again that the exit intent pop-ups convert better. Now, I think the one point of caution I would say is they get you more email addresses. They don't necessarily convert to sales any better. They may not. I think that it depends kind of on what your industry is. But at the same time, if you don't get an email address, then you have no opportunity to sell to them. So in a way, it makes more sense to get as many email addresses as you possibly can. There are, I'll say, certain people, myself included, who kind of feel like, well, you know, I don't want to be too intrusive about it. But at the same time, if you're offering a product or a solution that is extremely helpful to that audience, then it kind of is in, you know, it's kind of an obligation to get in front of those types of people in any way, shape, or form, because you can give them a lot of value. So there's different schools of thought on that. I'm kind of in the middle. I think that it really kind of depends on what type of product that you're selling as to whether or not I'd do it.
Yeah, I have a personal take. I don't like them as a user, and so I won't put them on my sites because I find them irritating. And I have heard that, like you said, you get more emails, but I use the justification of, oh, they're probably not going to convert as well because you've kind of forced people into it. I haven't tested it. It's just one of the things that I'm not willing to do. I mean, I think, you know, when I was back in the day reading a bunch of Dan Kennedy stuff about copywriting, he's a very good copywriter. I adopted the things that I was willing to ethically take on and the things that I was willing, the approaches I was willing to do and feel good about myself. You know, I never say something in a sales letter or on a marketing website that I wouldn't say face-to-face to someone at a conference or at a cocktail party, frankly. And that's just a personal thing, so that every day I wake up and I feel good about myself and I can tell my kids and my wife, like, this is stuff that I'm really proud of what I do and the value I give back. Now, in theory, are you leaving perhaps something on the table by not using one of these exit intents or by not using a more aggressive form of marketing? Yeah, in theory, sure. Is that extra 5% or 10% or 20% over the course of your life, is it going to make a huge difference if you feel like you are sacrificing something internally, whether you call it like a moral code or just something that you're not comfortable with, that you don't feel good about? It's your choice. I mean, different people have different lines. I think there's a lot of things in business like that, right? There are some absolute lines of legality and illegality, and then a lot of things that have gray areas, and I feel like this is one of them. And so certain people shout from the rooftops that exit intent is the way to go, and obviously they feel comfortable with it. Now, when I visit their sites and I get irritated by it, I'm much, much less likely to go back to their site. And I also have never, I don't think ever in my life, entered my email address into an exit intent pop-up. And I typically make a note like, all right, this is definitely a site that I'm not in love with. I don't feel like they treat me with respect when they use it. I feel like they're interrupting my flow and they're bothering my flow of web surfing and of consuming content on the internet. But maybe the site owner doesn't feel like that. And to kind of wrap it up, you know, for a long time, we didn't build an exit intent pop-up or exit triggered pop-up, as we call it, in Drip. But we found that in certain industries and certain niches, and just based on different marketers, certain people like them and they work for them. And so I realized that applying that piece of judgment on exit triggered stuff wasn't necessarily the way to go. And so we do, you know, offer it as a service if you enable it in Drip, but it's not something that I personally would use myself.
Yeah, I went back and just double checked while you were talking. I disabled it. So I don't recall whether or not I looked over the details of what it was, but I definitely tried it out. I don't think that there was a massive increase for me, and it just didn't seem worth it for wrecking the user experience, as you said, because I'm kind of in the same camp as you. Like, when I start seeing those exit pop-ups, I just kind of close the browser. Or if it's an article I really want to read, then I'll read it or click by it. But if I have to enter an email address to read it, I, out of principle, I just won't.
Yeah. And there may come a time when it's the norm and you have to deal with it. There may be a backlash at some point. I mean, I know ad blockers are coming up because of this type of thing, you know, because of the more aggressive advertising and these marketing approaches, ad blockers are being used by more and more people. And I think that's kind of a shame, frankly. I think that if we were able to all agree on kind of a decent level of advertising and marketing. I think that the internet becomes a better place, and I think people don't necessarily use that kind of stuff. But I've been trying to go just some basic news websites. Drip got written up on the Huffington Post yesterday. And just surfing around that site is like, there's so much stuff. The site is slow. There's JavaScript. There's videos auto-playing in front of me. It was crazy. I really haven't read news online in a long time because I consume most of it via podcasts. But I hadn't realized the state that we're in. And now I realize why these pop-up blockers are becoming so prominent. Our next question is from Richard Garside, and his question is on breathing life into an old product. He says, I really love the show and I find it very interesting. I'm setting my goals for the next year, and one thing I'm thinking about is whether or not to breathe life back into an old software product of mine called Font Picker, fontpicker.net. I created it when I had some spare time and it did quite well. Since then, I've not had as much free time and I've just left it for almost 2 years. Sales have slowed and they continue to do so. I think I could both improve the product and the marketing. I continue to get good feedback and feature requests from customers, and the app has a really good ranking in the Mac App Store. In some ways, this is kind of like buying an existing product that you think you can improve. I think you've covered everything I need in various shows, but how would you approach saving an existing product from a slow death and bringing it back to full glory? Some things I'm thinking about are improving the user interface design, improving the website, adding more features, and just improving my marketing ability. As a developer, I want to get stuck into new features, but perhaps that's not the most important thing. I'm also fighting the urge to rewrite it in Swift. Time is limited and I don't have time to do everything I want to do. Thanks for the shows and everything. What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is do not rewrite it. I mean, if you're trying to breathe life into an old product, especially one that's on the decline, then I don't think that rewriting it is going to make any difference. Your customers are not going to care that it's rewritten. So unless you're looking for some wholesale complete UI redesign, which I don't think entails a complete rewrite in a different language, that's probably not the way to go. In terms of a lot of the things that you mentioned, improving the UI, improving the website, adding more. I'm not so sure about adding new features, but definitely getting better at the marketing aspect of it. Obviously, those are all good things to pursue. But I think at the end of the day, you also have to ask yourself, is this something that you really want to do? Because if it's not something that you want to do, then you're basically going to either half-ass it or just not be committed to it. And at that point, the product itself is going to suffer.
Yeah, I'd agree with Mike. I would not rewrite it yet. If you decide you get into it and it starts making quite a bit of money and you decide that it really is a hassle to add features, you could consider it at that point. But at this point, all you want to do is figure out, can you even rehab this thing? Can you get more sales out of it? Because if you can't, then none of the other stuff is worth doing. So the first thing I would look at is, how are you going to drive more customers to it? Right? That's really what I would think. It's like, if you get a lot of your leads from the web, then I would probably redo your marketing website or at least improve the copy, make it look more modern. And if you have enough traffic to split test, that's fine. But if not, just go with your gut on this and try to improve it there. Or if you get most of your customers from the Mac App Store, then do some research on how to get your rankings up there. And if it's releasing new features, gets you mentioned or gets you reviewed or gets you whatever, then I do new features. But if not, then I would not be writing any code at this point. I would purely be looking at how to take the existing channels that are already driving customers, double down on those. How can you grow those by 50%, 100%, 200% over the next 3 months without writing any code, right? Any production adjustments to the app. You can obviously write web code if you're redoing the marketing site. So that's the first thing I would do. Second thing I would think about is, are there other channels, marketing channels, that you can start looking at? So with a small price point, obviously you're not going to be able to do something like advertising, but if you're not ranking well in Google, is there an SEO play here? If you're not ranking well in the App Store, obviously that's kind of a no-brainer to do it. Are there some JV partnerships where you could email your list and someone else emails their list? These are the types of things that I would start off right off the bat and attack. These are your early wins. It's your low-hanging fruit. Some of it's not going to scale, but if it gets you a nice little bump in sales, it all just aggregates and will build up over time. And then if you've proven that you can grow this thing and it is double, triple revenue, it's making enough money to make it worthwhile, then you can think about, oh, I'm going to add a bunch of features, and then you have something to talk about to your list. Oh, that's the other thing I would do. I would definitely get, I don't know if you're already collecting email addresses, but build the list, right? Build the list on fontpicker.net for something really cool that folks would want to know about. They're looking for font pickers, then I'm assuming it's a design audience. And so I had a 5-day mini course on how to pick the best font or something, you know, how to have fonts interact with color or whatever it is. I mean, there's certainly something off the top of your head that you'll be able to do, because that list will be huge for you. If you get a few thousand people on that, every time you release that new version, you can email that list and get that bump in sales. But that's probably where I would start. There's obviously a lot to it. Our next question is from Josh, and he's asking for some advice on either starting up a UX productized service or buying an existing business. He says, "Hey guys, I love the show. I've started dipping into old episodes and saving out things that you've talked about recently, namely what to not focus so much on when you're just starting out, etc. Here's my dilemma. I used to run a UX consulting firm. It wasn't scalable, and if I did it today, I would do it way differently. I would offer it as a productized service to startups and small businesses. So I'm considering that as one route. Then I was listening to one of your episodes, which mentioned buying an existing business. I did some research and found that I would need around 3 times my salary to make this happen. This shouldn't be an issue, as I have some money saved up from investments that I can use, and I can get 50% as a loan from the bank. So I'm debating either starting a UX productized service or buying an existing company for cash flow and running both of them in tandem." Oh, he has "and or buying an existing company and running both in tandem. My question is, how do I structure this as a business? Right now I have an LLC and have it registered as doing internet services. Would I be able to buy a company and roll it into the existing LLC, or should I do another corporation?" Wow, that actually, I don't think that's your question. I think your question is, should you do the UX consulting thing or acquire a business? And obviously I have a lot of thoughts, but why don't you kick us off, Mike?
Yeah, I wouldn't do both of them at the same time. I think the big red flag that pops out at me is buying something for 3 times your current salary, when it seems to me like you'd also have to get a loan. I think that's what he said, is he'd also have to get a 50% loan from the bank. And that seems to me to be a huge chunk of money to go out and plunk down on something where typically the returns on those, you're not going to get a full return on that for quite a while, because you're probably going to buy it for 3x the annual revenue or something along those lines. So I would have a really hard time going out and plunking down that kind of money for something that either I wasn't necessarily passionate about or didn't necessarily know enough about. And I haven't bought anything at that level. I think, Rob, you back in the day, you bought Hittail, and that was for a good chunk of money. But at the same time, it still had a lot of potential to it, I think.
Yeah, it wasn't nearly that amount.
Yeah. So like the dollar amounts, I think, are significantly different. I wouldn't personally feel comfortable dumping that much money into something if I wasn't really, really sure. And for me to be really, really sure, it would probably take a lot more than just like a month or two or even 6 months of like looking at the books and stuff. I'd want to be involved with the business before I bought it. I don't have any good advice on that other than don't do both at the same time. The other thing that does come to mind is look for something smaller to buy that you can run on the side.
And that grow it.
That seems to be like a better way to go, because then you can at least learn too. I think that the last thing you want to do is essentially learn on a big time production app. I mean, you're basically saying, oh, I'm going to go play in the majors, when you haven't even really played around in the sandbox, so to speak. It seems to me like a big risk.
I'm not,
I wouldn't be comfortable with it. Your mileage may vary on that one.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. The corporate structure, I think, is certainly the least of your worries. I'll talk a little bit about that in a second, but I'll cover it last because it's the lowest priority. I wholeheartedly agree. Absolutely do not do both at once. Pick one and go all in on that thing and grow it as large as you can. And then either have an exit from that or use the cash flow to do your next thing. But I really, really would encourage you not to try to do both at once, to grow two things. It does not work. In terms of acquiring, I agree. Buying something for 3 times your salary if you're not already versed in marketing products is quite a risk. I wouldn't say never do it, but it's a big risk, probably bigger risk than I would be willing to take. It doesn't feel like you're stair-stepping up. You know, if you already had a few WordPress plugins or a small SaaS app and you were looking to buy something for $200,000 or $300,000, I'd say we have the experience to do it. But just jumping up and trying to do that is really a big deal. I do know that in terms of, you know, Mike, you were concerned about the numbers not being valid or maybe the revenue not being there, whatever. I know that like when the reputable brokers like FE International, they do a ton of vetting. So I think the odds are pretty good. Obviously, it's possible that you could get there be an error and not have it actually be as successful as you want. But in my experience, the risk is going down now that these brokers are in here and actually doing a lot of vetting.
Yeah, I don't think it was the risk. For me, I don't think it's the risk so much of like you getting ripped off or not a good valuation, but just the time that it would take to get a return on that. It seems to me like if you're looking for something to just provide you with a stable income that you can grow incrementally over the next several years, great. But somebody got out of that business for a reason. And it may very well be that that reason is that they took the business as far as they could. And what guarantees do you have that you're going to be able to do any better with it? And it's not to say that you can't. I'm just pointing out that there is an inherent risk that says that you can't.
But I think that's the kind of the entire opportunity of buying a business is that you may get someone who, like me, is selling Hittail to focus on other things. I believe Hittail, I've seen Hittail do 3 or 4 times the revenue it's doing right now. It was very successful, but I haven't had time to focus on it. So the potential is there. I think you could also get someone selling like a lot of the ones I've acquired where someone built it and it had a single traffic source and the developer didn't know how to grow the thing, right? They didn't know how to 5X it or 10X it. And that could be an opportunity. So I think that's just part of the process of buying something based on an opportunity that you see. And so if you know how to do SEO or AdWords or content marketing, or you have a skill that you can apply and you see that someone's not doing any content marketing in a niche where it totally makes sense to do so, I think that's an opportunity. I mean, that's how I used to buy and grow things. But with that said, we don't know Josh's tool belt. And so Josh, if you don't have any marketing skills that are proven at this point that you've done really well in the past and had success with, then it is a bit of a risk. Now, I will say that I've been surprised. You can actually take out an SBA loan, at least in the US. There's a small business loan, and they just changed the rules in the past year to where you can now take it out to buy like software products, or I think, I'm assuming, you know, income generating online stuff. And the loan payment on a loan for, let's say, $200,000 or $250,000 is a lot less than the revenue or even the net profit you're going to make from an app that costs that. So there is margin there. I don't know if it's enough to live on, but it's an interesting approach. I am not the type to take out a loan to buy a business. It's just not my style. I'm going to be more stair-stepping up to doing it. But if you're all in and you need to go towards it right now, I do think that it's a interesting and or creative way of doing it. The other approach I saw recently is someone actually raising a small seed round from friends, family, and a couple more notable kind of advisor folks, basically like a little angel round to go acquire a SaaS app that has a ton of potential. And I know about this because I talked to him, you know, as a potential investor. And it's really interesting because the app already has product market fit. And with the team, I think there's a lot of potential there. And so it's kind of a no-brainer, because getting to that point is always costly and takes a lot of time. But if you can buy something that already has it, I think you're in a good boat. I think to wrap it up, the productized consulting, to be honest, is probably your, I don't know that I'd say your best bet, but I think it's more of a sure thing. And I actually think that waiting around and trying to find something to buy could take a while. You can't just make something appear in a niche that you want to be in. So if you're in a hurry, I'd probably do the productize. And if you're willing to wait around and take the risk, you could consider acquiring the app. The last piece of your question was, how do I structure it as a business? The thing is, you said, would I be able to buy a company and roll it into the existing LLC? Don't buy the company. You don't want to buy a company because companies come with liabilities, meaning if someone did something, got sued later on for that time period, you now have taken that on because you own the company. All you want to do is buy the product, essentially the assets of the company. And so once you have a product, you can, of course, roll that under an LLC or an existing corp structure. I am not a lawyer, so you'll want to consult one, but that is how I've seen it done many times here in the U.S.
Thanks for the question, Josh. I think that about wraps us up for time today. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.